So I want to welcome you to the 440th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. It's nice to see everyone here today, and also to welcome those listening on the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look. Each month, the Midcoast Forum, which was founded in 1983, invites an expert on some aspect of foreign affairs to speak and answer questions on an issue critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. Audios of past forum talks, information about upcoming forum programs, and information on how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. We're very pleased today to have Dr. Jacques Madut-Jacques with us today, speaking on U.S. military training of African forces, a source of influence or a national security risk. Dr. Jacques is a professor of anthropology at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs of Syracuse University. His areas of specialization include security, governance, democracy, and development in South Sudan and Sudan. He has also written extensively about gender, reproductive health, humanitarian aid, the ethnography of political violence, gender-based violence, and war, slavery, and the politics of identity in South Sudan and Sudan. Dr. Jacques has offered or co-authored a number of books, including Breaking Sudan, A Search for Peace, published by One World Publications in 2017. Before joining the Maxwell School, Dr. Jacques was visiting professor of anthropology at the University of Oxford and a fellow of Linacre College of the University of Oxford. He served in the government of South Sudan as undersecretary in the Ministry of Culture and Heritage from 2010 to 2013. He was the founding director of the Sud Institute of South Sudan, which is a public policy research center. Dr. Jacques, welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George. And thanks to Rob for inviting me, and thanks to all of you for being here today. It's my experience that great friendships begin so benignly in this manner and then be maintained for quite some time. So I'm really, really happy to see you and meet you and here to looking forward to further engagement and friendships. Thank you all for facilitating and inviting me to come here. So what I will do is ask three or four forward or leading questions before I go into to answer the question about U.S. Engagement in Africa, whether it is a way for U.S. to influence affairs in Africa or is it a liability. The first question is, why are there so many U.S. troops in Africa? As I will explain in a little bit, practically every African country, all the 54 of them, have U.S. military presence. Some very small, some mid-sized, some very large. The second question is, do Americans, when intervening in settings in Africa, care about African lives? The third is, to what extent is U.S. military engagement in Africa more likely a self-interest engagement than in the welfare of Africa? The last question is, what is the impact of U.S. military influence, presence in Africa, on the African continent, on African politics and African context? How much influence is there as a result of U.S. military engagement in Africa? And one way to answer all of these questions is to spell out some of the reasons that have been suggested and debated. So when you look at this map, you will see U.S. military footprints all across the African continent. The U.S. military presence is justified in a number of ways. One is that it's a joint effort to operate together with African militaries to address local conflicts, either civil wars or interstate conflicts. There are not a lot of interstate conflicts in Africa. Most of the African wars are internal wars. They are so-called civil wars. It strikes me odd in the English language that anything could ever be civil about war. But that's those are some of the things that have inspired the U.S. Involvement to try to tackle those wars, which is the reason why I was asking the question whether the U.S. involvement in Africa is for the welfare of Africans or is it a self-interest for the United States. And so the engagement, the idea that the U.S. train together with African forces is to strike two things at the same time. One is to create capacity for African military so that they will be the ones who deal with the security issues in their countries and in their regions, instead of foreign forces coming into Africa. If the African militaries were given the capacity that they lack by U.S. military, then Africans would be the one to take care of their conflicts rather than a lot of African countries being quote-unquote occupied by foreign forces, including U.S. The second part of that engagement is for U.S. to use that presence to as a buffer against militant groups, especially Islamic, sometimes terrorist groups. And these include Al-Shabaab in Somalia, which is the strongest outfit for Al-Qaeda globally. You will recall Al-Shabaab have been involved in hijacking of U.S. vessels. They were involved in the bombing of U.S. embassies in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam in 1998. They have been involved in Al-Qaeda operations in various places across Africa. So that's one group that the U.S. is trying to use its presence in Africa to create a buffer against. The second group is something called ISIS in Al-Maghrib. The Islamic State in Iraq and Syria in West Africa, in the Sahel region. It's an oxymoron. There cannot be an ISIS in West Africa because ISIS is for Iraq and Syria. But they have deployed and trained and recruited largely in the countries of Niger and Mali, and increasingly in the collapsed state of Libya. And so the U.S. is very, very concerned about ISIS in Al-Maghrib. And so training with African forces in Mali and Niger and Cameroon provides a platform for U.S. to watch this group. The third group is Boko Haram, which is a northern Nigerian Islamic movement. Boko Haram in the local northern Nigerian Hausa language translates as Western education is haram. And so what Boko Haram does is attack schools and abduct girls and marry them off to their fighters as a way to discourage girls and women's education, because for them, women's education is antithetical to an Islamic state, to a state where Sharia law, the Islamic law, should reign supreme. So they destabilize the whole region of northeastern part of Nigeria. And U.S. operations in Cameroon, and to a certain extent in within Nigeria itself, is to try to fight Boko Haram and prevent it from destabilizing and abducting people. The last one I want to mention of these groups is an operation that was high profile against something called the Lord's Resistance Army, which is a rebel movement in northern Uganda, and by far the most vile rebel movement on the African continent because of the things that it has engaged in, including not just abduction of children, boys and girls, and not just marrying them off to their commanders, but also in order to terrorize the region and entice young people into their ranks, they go into northern Ugandan villages, particularly the ethnic group called the Acholi, which is where their leader comes from. The leader of LRA is Joseph Kony. And the way they get young people to join the force, under duress, obviously, is to go into the villages and hack people to death, including seizing community leaders and cut their hands off, sometimes chopping girls' breasts off. And as a result, a lot of people who don't want to be subjected to this would quickly join the LRA. And once they are in the LRA ranks, they will be quickly trained and given guns to then be deployed to go back to their villages to be the ones who do the terror. Because once a child has committed an atrocious act against his uncle or her mother, then the relationship between the child and the community is severed forever because they would not be able to go back. They will now become completely loyal to the LRA and have no concern for their families and their communities. That was how LRA destabilized northern Uganda. And the U.S., together with other countries in the region, government of South Sudan, government of Congo, Central African Republic, all joined hands, given training by U.S. Marines in order to hunt for the Lord's Resistance Army commanders, particularly Joseph Kony, who has been most elusive and very difficult to find in the jungles of Central Africa. So these are some of the reasons why the U.S. Commits to the idea of doing two things, training together with African military so that capacity is left with the African armies, but also being there to watch the movements of some of these groups that destabilize the regions where they come from. The question then is, to what extent does U.S. military footprint in Africa actually pay off on a grand scale in terms of the U.S. being able to actually reap the benefits in terms of its own reputation in Africa, in terms of forging diplomatic relations with African countries, in terms of endearing itself to African countries in terms of trade, in terms of cooperation on numerous issues, including climate change and fighting desertification, because the Sahara Desert is croaching southwards every single day, to the point where if nothing happens, the entire forest belt in Africa will be wiped out by climate change and desertification. So, in order for the U.S. to engage on a number of these things, they use the military as a platform, as a foot in, as a goodwill gesture that they are there on the African continent in order to show that commitment, not just to fight terrorism, not just to stabilize the countries, not just to end civil wars, but to also then forge long-term relationships in trade, in military, in science, scientific cooperation, and sending African students to study in America, so that knowledge and that camaraderie and sense of togetherness is brought back to the African continent. This is the sort of the smart diplomacy that you will hear. This is what you will hear U.S. diplomats speaking of. This is what you will hear some African leaders themselves speaking of to justify the U.S. presence on the African continent. Well, what is the view from below? If that is the case from above, from both the African leadership, but also U.S. intervention level, what are the Africans saying about these interventions, about these engagements? So the strategy which the U.S. Has spelled out and has exercised has raised questions from below, from the ordinary Africans, who, though U.S. militaries are not always visible on the streets, everybody knows that the U.S. military is training together with African militaries. And this has raised concerns, including people saying there is a specter of imperialism, European imperial ideas being, so maybe this is a kind of neo-imperialism or neo-colonialism that is encroaching slowly, slowly through U.S. military presence. So I went to answer these questions. I went to South Sudan. I've been in Uganda. I've been in Central African Republic. I've been in Northern Congo. I have traveled in West Africa to ask this question. What do ordinary Africans think about the U.S. military presence on their soil, even in countries where there is no war to be fought? And by the way, some of the U.S. military presence doesn't go beyond a few Marines in the embassy. So it's not like there are American armies flocking into capitals. Much of the presence is very discreet, with very limited aims and purposes. So what I've heard in response to my questions about what do Africans think about this widespread military cooperation, one particular common response from Africans is that U.S. military presence and cooperation with the governments in some of these countries is a way that America is vouching and extending the arms of local dictatorship. Because if you are intervening in a country where there is no democracy of any kind, where there is no rule of law, where corruption is the rule of the day, where suffering of the people is the most common thing, despite the availability of huge resources, such that you are in Congo, a country which has so many resources, but where 6 million people have died over the last 20 years from arms being bought from various countries, including the neighboring countries in Africa, where suffering is the reigning reality, despite oil being in Angola, for example, despite Nigeria being a wealthy country, the sixth largest oil producer in the world, and yet has so much poverty. And so if you are in that country and you are intervening at the United States to support such a government, to what extent can we say that your intervention there is in the welfare of the African people? When in fact, the obvious consequence of your cooperation with that government is that the government becomes ever stronger and cannot be challenged by local activists and local opposition. So in a way, the U.S. has aided autocracy and dictatorship, and perhaps unbeknown to her. So that's one thing that I hear a lot. The second thing I hear a lot is that people always have mixed feelings about a foreign military being in one's country. On the one hand, you feel it's important that we get the knowledge that the U.S. military has and our forces can be trained to become a security force of an independent country with knowledge and with equipment. But on the other hand, the military presence of people from another country with the uniform of another country being seen offloading things from your airport triggers anti-U.S. sentiments because it looks like an invasion. You will recall in Iraq, just as a side note, when Saddam Hussein was overthrown in 2003 by U.S. military, the Iraqis were in jubilation all across the country for a few days. And then soon after that, they were not happy with the U.S. military walking the streets of Iraq. And it's because of these sentiments that arise when you feel like you are under occupation or under invasion. So this is what I hear a lot, the sense of conflicting views about what the value of U.S. military cooperation in Africa is. So to what extent can we say that U.S. military engagement in Africa has become a good tool for diplomacy, which has been espoused at the outset as the main reason why the U.S. does this cooperation? And I think if you go with ethnographic information, with the reports from local people, whether through journalists or long-term ethnographic research, what you find is that while the governments may be thankful to the U.S. for giving them the training, the ordinary people feel that the U.S. is either extending the autocratic rule or invading our countries. And especially when it comes to these ideas of fighting terrorism in Somalia, in the Sahel region, in northern Nigeria, the more the U.S. is seen engaging against these groups in those countries, the more terrorists you get. For every terrorist, Al-Shabaab terrorist, the U.S. kills, 10 are made because of that sentiment that we are under invasion. So, in the end, it is fair to conclude that U.S. engagement in Africa, for whatever reason, noble and important factors, notwithstanding, the reality is that U.S. presence in Africa has become a liability to the U.S. image. So then what should we do? And I will conclude with this question. If that is the case, if more and more Africans are feeling that the military presence here is a form of invasion and therefore is not really helping the diplomatic image of the United States, what should the military do, or what should the U.S. Do in that regard? This is just a map of the region I was describing earlier. In the hand for the Lord's Resistance Army, you have the Central African Republic, you have Congo, you have South Sudan, and Uganda is there to the south of South Sudan there. Many countries involved in that. And therefore, the U.S. is being seen, U.S. military being seen in these countries, in the villages, walking through the bushes, looking for RLA, and as a result, people feeling being invaded, even though the people in these countries were completely destabilized and devastated by LRA. And here is the U.S. military coming to help them, and it helped them 1 minute, and the next minute they feel invaded and become anti-U.S. It's very difficult to balance that. So here is a Ugandan helicopter or flying over the South Sudanese forces that were looking for LRA. Here is U.S. Air Force trainer with the Ugandan Army to deploy there in the Handful RRA. So then what to do is to really reevaluate military, the US military role, beyond terrorism, beyond counterterrorism, and go beyond supporting and training militaries in Africa, and think about other things that the US military could be doing. And what we have heard from military bases all across Africa is that there is a disconnect between the military leaders, especially the big military organizations like AFRICOM, on the one hand, and then the US politicians, the people who run the country and who make decisions where military should go on the African continent. There is a disconnect from the perspective of Africans between the US military and the American civilian leadership. In the last government, the one before the current one in the United States, things got worse because the person in the White House at that time had not only been uncommunicative with Africans, he had actually shown quite a lot of disrespect to the Africans. And so what the people are saying is to bring the military leaders together with the politicians and visit Africa together. It didn't happen, obviously, in the days of President Obama. It's likely to happen under the current administration, but that is what will sell better and be more impactful, which is engagement of both military and civilians together with Africans, rather than the politicians in Washington sending militaries to do the diplomacy for them through military engagements, because it has backfired a lot of times. And so it is time to look at other types of cooperation. Even when you have military, you should also have military scientific engagement. In Kenya, the US, the Walter Reed Medical the medical team from Walter Reed, they have a scientific base in Western Kenya. And they work together with the Kenya Medical Research Institute to do disease surveillance. And this type of engagement, especially in the days of pandemics and epidemics, perhaps the US military could engage more on these issues of disease surveillance in order to use the power of the scientific power of the military to build relations with the African communities. Because right now there is a lot of talent in Africa, scientific talent, but African governments don't invest in research. They don't inject enough money into labs. And now you find that Africans are simply waiting and begging for the rest of the world to bring COVID vaccines to them, when in fact there is so much talent, there is in fact a lot of equipment, but there is no money being given to these scientists in order to produce drugs and vaccines in there. And if the US military invests in that, I think it would go a long way, much longer way than military training. I'll stop here and see if people have any questions and comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. These are problems I don't think most of us think about a lot of the time. And it's really useful to hear about them. While we're collecting questions, and I'm going to start sorting them out, I always start with a question of my own. And that is about, you know, what the reasons really are for the U.S. military presence in Africa. You've talked about a couple. One is a purported reason of stabilizing countries that are undergoing civil strife. A second was counterterrorism. But a third one that you didn't mention is we all know that China has increased its influence and presence in Africa. Is there an element of the U.S. presence there that's related to countering the Chinese presence there? Or is that just immaterial to all of this?
No, absolutely. It's actually on my list here in the slides. And I can leave the slides back. People can have them. Yes, the U.S. is definitely concerned and watching China. In fact, anecdotally, you will recall that South Sudan is Africa's youngest, the world's youngest country, got independence in 2011. Largely thanks to U.S. Support for the people of South Sudan and paying for the referendum that where South Sudanese voted for independence in 2011. But soon after the country became independent, the leaders of that country started cooperating aggressively, seeking China's support with their infrastructure, with oil production, with other types of investments, eventually leading to break of diplomatic relations between Sudan and the United States. And the number one cited reason why the U.S. is upset with the leaders in South Sudan is because of China's role in that country. China had been a powerful force in Sudan before the country broke up into two, and had been the oldest ally on the African continent for China. And so now that China has moved into numerous countries in terms of building infrastructure, giving loans, loans that are extremely opaque in terms of what it was used for, loans whose repayment plans are not accessible to the ordinary people, contracts that nobody has seen, and then loans become very due quite quickly. And when they become due, it turns out that Chinese loans have very, very, very short repayment plan and very, very high rates of interest, to the point that now China is taking over infrastructure that it had built. I just read last night that they're threatening to take over Kenyan railway, which they built recently. They took over the Zambian railway and they took over Zambian copper mines. And they're threatening to take the airport in Entebbe, in Kampala. And all of it, before you even talk about the famous road and bridge program that China is infiltrating, not just Africa, but a lot of the eastern part of the world. And so, yes, the U.S. definitely is present in Africa for the purpose of trying to do a counterbalance, to be a counterweight to the Chinese role there, except that it is not going to be done militarily. It's going to be done diplomatically, and it's going to be done in terms of economic development, that the U.S. needs to offer more to the African countries so that they don't have to seek this debt trap with China. And definitely China has been trapping the African continent in terms of debts, and it will be very difficult to repay those debts.
So you've just talked about this a little bit, but if I could get you to expand, here's a question. In Africa, is there parallel skepticism toward the Chinese presence, or is Africa more careful about keeping their military presence at a minimum?
At first, there was not as much skepticism. Let's say about 10 or 15 years ago, when this began to bloom, there was not as much skepticism. But then the Chinese have done things that have raised concerns for Africans. The first thing that China does is that in all of these projects, whether it is mining project or construction projects, they bring their labor force from China. A lot of it, I'm told, is prison labor force, which come to Africa and get paid peanuts to work on this construction. And therefore, the aspirations that Africa had that these construction projects would also involve African labor force, not just for pay, but for training, such that knowledge is left behind when the project is done, this is not happening. So it has begun to really anger Africans that small things like people sweeping the floors of a factory, you don't need a Chinese for it. people who are driving construction equipment. You don't need Chinese for it, but they bring them. There is also the issue of management cultures are different. The Chinese managers don't have that much capacity to communicate to Africans in ways that are culturally appropriate. And it was the concern also for the US military, the idea that one way to train the US military is to actually give them a bit of cultural background of the people with whom they engage, because cultural appropriateness goes a long way in diplomatic engagement. So yes, I think the issue of skepticism from African perspective regarding foreign intervention, whether US or Chinese, is growing, and it's growing even more for China because of this element of debt trap, issue of foreign labor force, issues of loans that are opaque and people don't know, because some of these loan contracts are signed in Beijing by African leaders who go there and be given gifts and kickbacks and sign them there and then come back with money in suitcases. And there is no transparency about what these loans mean and what is going to be they're going to be used for. So people are getting very, very agitated with China.
Let me switch gears a little bit now. And I know you just got back from the region, and we have a number of questions on what the U.S. position is toward the current military takeover in Sudan and what the situation is there.
Right.
Could you make some comments on that, please?
Certainly. So you will also be aware that Sudan was under a vicious Islamic military dictatorship for 30 years, from 1989 to 2019. And in 2019, that dictatorship under somebody called Omar al-Bashir was thrown off through an uprising, a popular civilian uprising, which took over the streets of the major cities, and the elements of the military who were sympathetic to this uprising joined the protest. And when the regime military tried to quell that by force, it became nearly a confrontation between two sides of the military, the pro-protest military and pro-regime military. And when it became very close to being a showdown between these sections, the protest was allowed to move on. And the negotiation went on with between the civil society groups, the professional associations, the student union, women's union, union of journalists, all kinds of people. They all sat together and said that Sudan needed to be reestablished as a state, because for 30 years and even much longer than this, perhaps dating to 1956 when it became independent from Britain, Sudan had, under the Islamist leadership, has always forged this identity of being an Arab country, an Arab Islamic country, when in fact the percentage of people who are Arabs is very, very, very small compared to the rest of the ethnic groups all across the country. And so they said that we have to sit down and reforge the identity of this country to rebuild and set up a country that is based on citizenship and not on the color of skin or the faith, but simply based on people being citizens of one country. And that they succeeded. So all the dictatorship and all his cronies were sent to jail. They're still in jail today. But last October, the elements of the military who were pro-dictatorship staged a coup against this arrangement. So now there is a duel between the forces of protest and the military junta who have taken over. So there is a military putting the United States in a serious dilemma. Because when the dictatorship left, the US could finally relinquish some of the assets of the Sudan that had been frozen because of terrorism. The US could finally cooperate with the government in place against terrorism. The US could simply cooperate in terms of training. And the Sudan could once again join the community of nations, as not as a pariah that it had been for three decades. But with this military takeover again, by elements who were pro al-Bashir, including the deputy to the current military ruler, is somebody called Daglo. Daglo is the commander of Rapid Support Force, which is the militia that wreaked havoc in Darfur and committed genocide there. Now he's the number two in that country. What is the US going to do about that kind of government? If you say, okay, we'll go back to the days of sanctions, then the ordinary people who are protesting will say you are punishing us. If you let the military reign supreme the way it is today, Sudan will go back to the days when it is a state sponsor of terrorism. So, and that is a very delicate situation for the United States. I think most likely they are going to try to reforge relations with the military junta and try to nudge them away from terrorism, but which will not happen, of course, because Sudan is much, much too important to the Islamic movement to abide by any US diplomatic nudging.
Complicated situation.
Indeed.
I'll switch gears again. Several questions here about the role that oil might have played in the US military presence and cooperation with some of the governments. What role did oil play, does oil play in all of this?
Oil is a big part of the geopolitics of the US in Africa. In South Sudan and in Sudan in general, the first oil wells were, well, oil in general was discovered by Chevron. And they were the first to mine it, to operate it in 1978. And they operated it, trained a lot of Sudanese and South Sudanese oil workers, brought to the United States, and pumped a lot of money into it. But then the civil war started in 1983. And that civil war shut down the Chevron operations. And the oil was now left to be in the ground until 1989, 1990, when a Canadian oil company, oil and gas company called Talisman, bought the operations from not just Chevron, but others who had bought from Chevron, like a Pakistani company called Arakis, and Indian companies, Swedish companies had been trying to get in, but Talisman became the biggest one, and it was now the one that that produced the oil of Sudan. And as they were producing the oil of Sudan, they intensified the war, the civil war. How did that happen? Well, in order for the oil trucks to leave the swampy area where the oil fields are, which is within a region in Sudan called the Sirt. This is the world's largest freshwater swamp, and that's where the oil is. So in order for oil to be produced and taken out, the oil companies built all-weather high roads, highways into the swamps. So the oil trucks came to get the oil, but they were followed by military trucks who invaded the region and expelled the entire population from that area. So oil and military are bread and butter. And so what happened is that the oil companies facilitated the genocide against the people living on top of the land where the oil comes from. It raised a lot of protests all across the North America, and eventually Talisman was delisted from New York Stock Exchange because of civil society activists saying, no, we don't want blood money, oil money, basically blood money. You will also recall the Olympics in Beijing, where they became termed as Blood Olympics. A lot of celebrities in the United States protested. Eventually, Talisman got out. All the Western companies got out, only to be replaced by Asian companies. The Chinese oil corporation called CNPC, the Malaysian corporation called Petronas, and an Indian company. You see the problem with oil is that if it is mined by by Western companies, there is a bit of transparency, because the oil companies from the West are listed on the stock market, and anything that taints their image could be a loss to the shareholders. So there is usually a tendency to be more transparent with your actions. But if you are a Chinese, which is a state corporation, it looks like a private one, but it's actually a Chinese government-owned, a state corporation of Malaysia, a state corporation of India, in their countries, they don't even care about human rights. So why would they care about producing oil that is killing people in a faraway country? And they are not subject to being influenced by opinions on the stock market, so they are not listed there. So the Chinese and the Indians and the Malaysians have taken over the oil production in South Sudan, simply feeding the dictatorship, giving them the money, and oil is antithetical to democracy, because oil proceeds are not known to the public. So the public cannot go and say, where's our money? Because they don't know how much money. If it is taxpayers' money, people can go and say, where's our tax money? Why are you not building schools? Why are you not doing roads with our money? But if it is oil money, sometimes the deal is made from in a faraway capital, and the money is given out there, and the local public doesn't know anything about it. So oil is the best way to kill a people's tendency for democratic rule.
Thank you. well, it's killing the world, so yeah. You know. Is it a question that follows up on some comments you made at the end of your presentation. And this one says, do we really want to expand the role of the U.S. military into civilian development activities like disease control, or limit their mission to military issues and return to bilateral assistance, diplomacy, et cetera?
Good question. Indeed, I think any kind of cooperation that involves the military is always going to be shrouded in suspicion. No question about it. Even if it is well-intended and it's science-based and it's likely to help, the only reason why people call for such cooperation is that the Walter Reed Army Institute has already invested heavily in countries such as in Thailand, in Kenya, in Ethiopia, and other countries, that to lose all that knowledge and all that interaction and limit that research to civilian and take out the military is probably going to take a long time in order for that good research that is being done to be carried on. But definitely, I think it is a question worth considering. How much is it more worth to have the military continue this role than replace it with the civilian universities, for example, or other scientific institutions that are run by civilians? Why can't you have that rather than have it done by the military? I think it's a good proposition, in my view. I think it's going to take a long time for that to pan out, if it ever starts.
And here's one that's in yet a different direction. Mm. Just a more general question. Of the 54 African countries, about how many are autocratic? How many are corrupt? Are there real bright spots that we should follow and others should emulate?
I think, well, let me just start by saying that all governments have autocratic tendencies. So it's a matter of degree. And it's also a matter of the level of enlightenment and education of the population to know what their rights are and to know how to demand those rights through organizing themselves as communities of citizens who are informed about how their government is either helping them or cheating them. And so if you look across Africa, you will find some countries have this, they have all kinds of of ways in which governments cheats people. And so it depends on the history of political leadership following the demise of colonialism in the 1960s. And so if you look at countries like Tanzania, which was a poor country but was run by a really kind-hearted philosophical leader called Mwalimu Julius Nyerere. Nyerere did one thing that has led to stability of Tanzania to this day. And that is, he said he designed programs that help people graduate from their tribal citizenship into citizenship in the nation as a whole. Such that in Tanzania, you hardly ever hear of people fighting along tribal lines. He imbued every citizen with a degree of pride and loyalty to the state and the nation rather than to their regions or their ethnic groups. And so when you have a country like that, you have a semblance of a level-headed government which can be challenged by its citizens. And you can go with it until a mad person comes to power again, and then it takes it all back. You also have autocracies that are combination of heavy-handed, iron-fisted rule with delivery of services. People in Africa refer to this as benevolent dictators. People like Paul Kagame in Rwanda, who has taken Rwanda from the ravages of the genocide in 1994 to being the Switzerland in the middle of Africa now. And he did this by silencing everyone. No opposition. People who opposed the government were either jailed or lynched. Even in exile, when they ran away, they would be killed in exile. In South Africa, some of them would be arrested in Switzerland and Belgium and brought back and tried and jailed. So he did stabilize Rwanda to the point where now every investor who is dreaming about Africa thinks of Rwanda first. Every major research institution and university thinking of opening shop in Africa, they think about Kigali. The Johns Hopkins, the Princetons of this world have all moved in to have hospitals and such. So there you go. I mean, I might be able to give up a few of my civil rights any day in order to live in a stable and peaceful Rwanda. Rwanda has one problem, and that is Congo. Congo is being raped by all countries around the world, including Rwanda. Rwanda now has a diamond that is branded as Rwandan. Rwanda does not have diamond mines. That diamond comes from Congo. Because there was a war in Congo where African governments, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Rwanda, and Uganda intervened to try to stop the war, but instead of stopping the war, they went on mining spree for themselves. And they destroyed Congo even more. That is remaining a taint on the government of Rwanda. So yes, there are. I can say every single African country is under a dictatorship of one side or another. The bright spots are there. Botswana, for example, which has, when I was Under Secretary of, we went to Botswana to learn from their experience about how they use their diamonds to build such a vibrant democracy. And the president told us, you have oil, you have gold, produce it, but don't spend the money. Put it away, just save it somewhere, just put it on independent fund somewhere. Don't spend it. Then, because oil is not a job creator as an industry, because it's such a high-skill industry that only technicians and managers will be employed in it. So what you do with oil money is take the oil money you divide it money ways, take one-third to fire up the engines of the rest of the economy, agriculture, animal husbandry, fisheries, tourism, and all the rest of it. You use that money to build the industries. Put a third away for rainy day, and use the third to build the state, to employ people. In doing so, you will actually employ, in a country like South Sudan, you could employ easily 3 million people in those sectors. If you employ 3 million people out of 12, these 3 million people will pay taxes. Take the tax money and use it to run the state. Keep the oil money stashed away, because oil is such a, it's a finite industry, and it's such a volatile industry. If you take the money and eat it, as South Sudanese will say, and when it runs out, you have nothing.
I know you're going to have to leave, but yeah. I wanted to finish with one additional question, and that is the effect of the current political situation in the U.S. On the United States' influence in Africa.
Well, without suggesting being or condemnatory of the government of the United States prior to this one, I think that was a disaster. With regards to U.S. influence or presence or cooperation with Africa. Our then president made so many faux pas that it was it's almost impossible to find a comeback. And it's taken the current administration, it's already taken a year, and the U.S. has not come back to its glory days with regards to Africa. I think it's gonna take a well-crafted foreign policy team at the State Department and in White House to reforge those relationships, because not only is Africa the next frontier in terms of mineral resources and land use and agriculture and water, Africa can also be a liability in the sense that if people are going through civil wars, people are, like South Sudan was just demolished by flooding the other day, like worst flooding in decades because of the climate change or weather conditions that are induced by climate change, let me say it that way. And so you need a team in the United States that obviously self-serving like any country does, but seeing that what serves the United States the best is to keep away issues of food shortage and famines before they come, because then the U.S. doesn't have to respond by trying to stage a humanitarian mission. What is more humanitarian is to help people produce their own food rather than intervene when the food is run out. I think, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.